May it please the Court, Michael Codner on behalf of Petitioner Gabriel Almanza-Arenas. There are two central issues that drive the current petition before the Court. First one being whether there was a proper determination regarding the crime of moral turpitude, or CMT, which was what we call for
short. Well, why don't you project your voice, huh? And you don't have to read, just talk to us.
Understood, Your Honor. Understood. I apologize. The second issue being whether the petty offense exception was properly applied in this respect in terms of saving him from the CMT finding. Starting with the cancellation application, I believe an important starting point is from a citation from Justice Fletcher's dissent, which Justice Pregerson and Justice Fisher joined.
Counsel, we're not justices.
Your Honor, I apologize.
There's no justice on the Ninth Circuit. That's been good for a laugh for 100 years.
Fair enough.
Okay.
I believe the quote that is important is, Congress intended that an application for cancellation of removal be decided on the basis of whether state court records happen to be sufficiently clear to prove a negative. Under this framework, I would direct the Court's attention to 10851A under the California Vehicle Code, which was determined.
Why don't you just speak plain English so we can understand you? You got something to go through?
I do, Your Honor.
You know, you've got Almanzana. He was undocumented, and he was convicted under California Vehicle Code 1051A. Huh?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. And,
so it could have been either joyriding or car theft.
Could have been joyriding or auto theft.
It absolutely could have, Your Honor.
Okay. Then where do you go?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that that's where it's important under the categorical analysis, where the new decision from the Supreme Court, Moncrief, comes in, and I believe directly addresses is the Young's decision, the Young decision from this Court.
Not quite. So you should pursue that, but Moncrief does not directly address Young because Young was a modified categorical case, and so it would be very helpful if you can address it in those terms, because we all have a great interest in the vitality of Young, since I was on that en banc panel.
Understood, Your Honor.
I can assure you that I have a direct interest. We all do. So I'd like you to be careful in your distinction.
Understood, Your Honor. I think the first comparison between the two is that in Moncrief, while they didn't use the words modified categorical analysis, they were proceeding in somewhat under the modified analysis because they looked at Moncrief's change of plea to hook it to the legal basis that they've determined is what's relevant in the categorical analysis. So I think that's one reason to show that.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, that you're interested in the language in Moncrief, this language. We must presume that the conviction rested upon nothing more than the least of the acts criminalized, and then determine whether even those acts are encompassed by the generic federal offense.
Correct, Your Honor.
You like those words?
I do. I'm a fan of those words.
That's what it is. All right.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that that's where the Moncrief decision addresses the Young Court in the respect of it doesn't mention the burden of proof. I can't deny that. I wish that it did.
Because the burden of proof wasn't relevant in Moncrief. It was relevant in Young, given the posture of it was a removal case.
It was, Your Honor, but I think that Your Honor, I'm sure, has read from the Moncrief decision. They said that this...
I've carefully read it.
So have I, probably 15 times, and I get a different result in terms of something coming up new that I need every time. The point being is that it took the analysis of the categorical analysis and said, this is a legal analysis, no matter what. It is not a factual analysis. This is a legal analysis, and that's why I think that it addresses the burden of proof issue in the fact that it says that in removability or relief context, it's the same. The point is that Young and the Board's focus on the differing burdens between removal and eligibility has been blown apart, for the most part, by Moncrief, in my belief. Again, I go back to Justice Pregerson's, Your Honor's, citation to this. And it says that it does address this in the respect of taking it away from the burden of proof issue. Equally important, I think, is Moncrief's focus on two things, that there's a presumption of neutrality, irrespective of who retains the burden, and reiteration that any ambiguity, which I think there was an issue here because we had an inconclusive record, any ambiguity lies in favor of the alien. I think these points directly address Young. The focus on the party who bears the burden runs the risk of non-persuasion. Now, in keeping the focus of the relevant inquiry on being one of a legal basis, Moncrief negates the focus again on the party who bears the burden. I think a further extension of this reading is if we look at the preponderance of the evidence standard, which does relate to the burden of proof. This is a factual situation that's reserved for credibility, for continuous presence, and there's nothing to show that from the Moncrief decision that this is extended to the legal inquiry from the categorical analysis. That is what we cannot get away from here. Regardless of the burden of proof, we are dealing with the categorical analysis here of a crime. And it reverts us back to that initial statement that Your Honor stated, that it's the focus is what the crime necessarily rested on. I think that Young is also inconsistent with Moncrief's analysis of the statutory framework of removal proceedings. As we know, removal proceedings have two parts. They have the removability and then the relief from removability. For the first part, the government is required to produce documents that show a charge of removability. For the second part, if the immigration court finds the non-citizen removal, the non-citizen presents his or her case for relief. Moncrief confirms that once the government fails to establish that a conviction results in removability, even if it wasn't charged, but if we're dealing with the CMT provision here, that conviction cannot subsequently form the basis of a bar to relief from removal. This is precisely what the board did in the present case. I think the point is, pursuant to the controlling regulations, which is at 8 CFR 1240.8D, when an immigration court addresses a criminal bar to relief, the government already would have produced documents relating to the criminal bar in its case for removability. This is what happened in this case. The government produced the records. They produced the change of plea. They produced the complaint. What is relevant is that they didn't request the transcript, probably knowing that it would have been irrelevant. Contrary to Young, Moncrief explains that this is sometimes an insurmountable burden when we're dealing with an inconclusive conviction record. In other words, the burden that Young places on non-citizens to obtain what they believe to be conclusive records is mostly impractical. I think, more importantly, Moncrief limits the Nishwan decision in connection with the CMT analysis, which was at issue here. The underlying reasoning is the circumstance-specific approach from Nishwan only applies in the rare circumstance, which is when it is in itself written in to the immigration statute by a qualifying phrase. Moncrief, I think, supports this conclusion reached by several circuit courts that the CMT grounds do not support the Nishwan analysis because they do not include the express directive to examine the underlying conduct. And I would refer that to the 4th, 11th, and 3rd circuits. Now, by excluding the Nishwan mini-trial analysis from the CMT review, I think Moncrief appears to reiterate in the CMT review, there must be a definitive ending point in this legal analysis. Or as this court appropriately put forth in Young, either the record of conviction either establishes that the applicant was necessarily convicted of the predicate offense, or the record does not. It's one or two. This is not what Young does.
No, I mean, that's a good speech. Everybody in this courtroom just follows every word that you're uttering. You know, take us through this labyrinth, huh?
It is a labyrinth nonetheless, Your Honor.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you represent Arenas. That's the easy way to refer to it.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he was undocumented. He was convicted of violating 10851. Of the vehicle code, okay? And we know that that can cover both joyriding and auto theft. And he's seeking, what, cancellation of removal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then you need three things. Continuous physical presence, et cetera, 10 years, and takes care of that.
And also the hardships.
I know. Good moral character. And not have been convicted of an offense under 88, under 1182A2, 1227A2, or 1227A3. And the removal would result in extreme and unusual hardship. U.S. citizen, this way, permanent resident. All right, so car theft and joyriding. It classifies aliens as inadmissible for visas based on convictions for certain crimes involving moral turpitude. All right, and then we go to the next one to determine whether he's been convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude. I'd like to say moral turpentine, but turpitude is better. We look to the four Shepherd documents, right? The charging document, the transcript, the plea agreement, the comparable judicial record, and your client didn't submit transcripts because they would not have been helpful. Apparently, he pled pursuant to People v. West, which the defendant does not admit to any factual allegations. Car theft involves moral turpitude. Joyriding does not. And then here the record is inconclusive as to whether your client was convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude. Then we go to Young v. Holder. And the Ninth Circuit held that a petitioner with an inconclusive record of conviction is not eligible for cancellation of removal. And then we move on to the Supreme Court's decision in Moncrief, and we come to that wonderful sentence I read earlier, that you penalize the least of the acts criminalized and determine whether even those are encompassed by the generic offense. And if we do that, it's joyriding, and your guy's home free. That's what you like. Huh?
That's a real good game plan, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. I got your argument well in hand.
There is one issue that I would like to address with the West.
It's going to be on the bar exam.
I think I'd be ready to take it at this point. I think, just going back to the West plea for a moment, I do believe that the agencies did have an improper understanding of what a West plea is. The point being is if we have a proper understanding of what this West plea is, it tells them that this insistence on the transcript of plea would have been entirely irrelevant and would not have done anything to further the analysis. I practiced before the Superior Court in San Diego. I've gone through these pleas. Every single time, without exception, all of the judge does is he takes the change of plea and reads it into the record. They do not add any kind of factual basis for this. And I think that that's important because it reverts back to the Ruiz decision, which states that there was no factual basis for guilt.
We're familiar with West pleas.
Oh. Yeah.
I understand. And I did want to address the court's issue in Valdovinos, which said that it understood that, okay, well, let's go back and revert back to the complaint and see what that does to help us here. Valdovinos doesn't hurt us in this respect because if we go back to the complaint, it is, as Your Honor stated, worded in the conjunctive, and it would not have provided whether it was joyriding or not. I have 1 minute remaining, Your Honor, and I would like to address the petty offense exception.
You only got a minute and 12 seconds.
I do, Your Honor. Yeah. I think my biggest point with regard to the petty offense exception obviously comes to literal language between 1227 and 1182. Our strongest argument in this respect is that the board arbitrarily reads out the admission in the five-year language with respect to the petty offense exception.
Could you explain in your approach to this the relevance of Chevron deference to the BIA's interpretation?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that in Gonzales, this court had indicated that this is not an unambiguous statute. So I don't believe that we're to the second part of the Chevron deference where we have to give it to the board. So that's my biggest issue in terms of addressing where we are with Chevron with this statute.
So you're relying on it's ambiguous, and therefore we don't give any deference to Chevron,
I'm relying
to the
on
BIA?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm relying that I think that that's exactly what it is. 1227 is plain in its language. It says admitted within, it uses the words admission and within 5 years. And for the board to read those out and just to arbitrarily skip over it, I don't understand how that's able to be squared. And I think that the Second Circuit's recent decision from Friday is an extremely telling factor of how irrational the board's reasoning in this respect. And I understand that this issue is before the court in the following petition, and I understand that it will be addressed more, but I think that Reyes case is extremely telling. And I would reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
What's the cite for that Second Circuit case?
The Second Circuit case, I provided a 28J letter, Your Honor. It is Reyes versus U.S. The docket number is 11-5409-AG, and that is the Second Circuit opinion. Issue date was May 3rd, 2013. And I did provide a copy of the Reyes decision in my 28J letter.
Okay.
May it please the Court. My name is Carol Federighi. I represent the respondent, the Attorney General Eric Holder, in this case. The Board of Immigration Appeals reasonably concluded that Mr. Almanzo was not eligible for cancellation of removal because the record was inconclusive as to whether he had been convicted of a disqualifying offense, and he declined to produce relevant documents requested by the immigration judge. Under 8 U.S.C. 1229 A.C.4a, Mr. Almanzo had the burden of proof to establish that he was eligible for relief, including the burden to establish that he was not convicted of a disqualifying offense. The conviction record before the immigration judge was ambiguous as to whether he was convicted of the turpitudinous part of the vehicle theft statute. Therefore, the IJ permissibly and reasonably asked Mr. Almanzo to produce additional documents, specifically the plea colloquy, to see if that would help resolve the inconclusiveness of the record. Mr. Almanzo declined to produce the plea colloquy. The immigration judge accordingly reasonably held that the inconclusiveness of the record would be held against Mr. Almanzo, who had the burden of proof, and that he had therefore not met his burden to show that he had not been convicted of a disqualifying offense. This conclusion is consistent with the court's en banc decision in Young, and it's not overruled by Moncrief. First, the holding in Young was that an inconclusive record, an alien does not meet his burden of proof to establish his eligibility for relief by relying on an inconclusive record of the conviction. This Almanzo follows that holding in Young and, in fact, goes beyond it and says, in addition, the burden is not met where the alien has been requested to produce additional documents and hasn't done so. Moncrief, in contrast, was in a different context. Moncrief did not involve a relief application, although, to be sure, the court did refer to relief applications in describing the relevance of an aggravated felony in the immigration context. In fact, the context in Moncrief was just the determination of removability, where the government has the burden of proof. Moncrief, therefore, did not address the burden of proof provision at issue here, and that the Young court also specifically relied on. Moncrief, therefore, does not indicate or even suggest how the court's analysis would play out in a case involving relief where the burden of proof is on the alien. Judge Pragerson has pointed to excerpt in Moncrief where the court states that analyzing convictions under the categorical approach, you have to presume that the conviction rested on the least culpable conduct. That paragraph then goes on to say that there are some qualifications to that rule, and then just goes on to describe the modified categorical approach. So in a sense, what the court is saying is under the pure categorical approach, yes, you presume that the least culpable conduct is the conduct at issue, but you can use additional documents relating to the conviction to establish that the conviction was actually under one portion of the statute.
Under Moncrief, though, if the default rule is it always benefits the applicant, wouldn't that have some impact on the burden of coming forward with evidence? So if Moncrief suggests that the least disadvantaged interpretation of the conviction applies, why would an applicant ever come forward with additional categorical evidence?
Well, that is correct. If the analysis of Moncrief was applied sort of, you know, without further analysis to the relief case, it would result in that contraindicative result where the alien is, he has the burden of proof, and yet he could sort of pick and choose what documents to present to the immigration court to show that he had an inconclusive record and not to resolve the conclusivity. So that is why, in the relief context, well, that's probably one reason that the burden is on the alien to establish his removability, both by statute and by regulation.
Would it, I mean, in this case, the argument's made that it wouldn't have established it if he'd come forward with the plea transcript. I mean, or was the Supreme Court perhaps responding to that there's just simply a lot of cases where it's either difficult or impossible for the alien to come forward with the evidence, or the evidence itself doesn't prove one way or the other?
That's a basis for distinguishing this case from Moncrief. In Moncrief and also in Young, there was no question raised by the parties or the court that there were possibly documents missing. In this case, the immigration judge said, I would like to see the plea colloquy. Now, it is true that the petitioner has argued that the plea colloquy wouldn't help, it wouldn't establish what he pled guilty to. But I would respectfully disagree with that. I think a West plea is, it's not always clear exactly what went on in a West plea, and the court's precedents, both the California courts and this court, also make clear that what a West plea means is that there's, it could mean any of several different things.
The West plea was inconclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Under Moncrief, how are courts then to interpret whether or not it's a disqualifying conviction?
We would still argue that Young would apply, and that the court should still apply the burden of proof provision to hold that the alien has not met his burden of proof. I just want to remind the court this is a stronger case.
How do you prove it if neither the charging instrument or the plea colloquy or the plea deal shows one way or the other whether the disqualifying offense or a non-disqualifying offense is involved?
The alien would be limited to the Shepherd document, so would be limited to what was before the agency, like in Moncrief and Young.
None of them show.
Yeah, and then in that case, he would be out of luck with regard to his application for relief.
What Moncrief suggests should happen when it's inconclusive?
Moncrief doesn't really address that precise situation. Again, it didn't address the burden of proof provision. It didn't address this problem, which might advocate for a different interpretation of the burden of proof production. It just didn't get there. And the court would be leaping beyond the language of Moncrief to hold that Moncrief overrules Young.
And I take that point. I mean, the difference between cancellation and removal and the burden of proof is critical to Young. But the Moncrief opinion, in discussing the policy reasons underlying the categorical rule and the default presumptions and the burdens on the immigration courts and the disadvantages that the immigrant has in obtaining evidence, all read contrary to the premise of the majority opinion in Young. That was discussed quite eloquently in the conflicting opinions. So now we have Moncrief coming along and validating the concerns of those who were not enamored of the majority interpretation. So is Young undermined, if not overruled? Because the Supreme Court makes it clear it doesn't think the immigration courts were intended by Congress to turn into a litigation battle on the fine points of whether or not the facts of the case, as opposed to the nature of what the plea was or the resolution was. And that's squarely the problem of Young, because Young is, I mean, the modified categorical approach is not one that opens up normally a big evidentiary battle. What it does is gives the government the chance to produce some judicially noticeable documents that can provide clarification. But that's the effect of Young could well be seen as saying, well, we're going to actually turn it into a mini trial, and the immigrant will have to do the best he or she can to come in and persuade the immigration judge that this was not a crime of moral turpitude or whatever the issue may be.
The Young decision didn't hold that the alien could come forward with facts regarding his offense or
right.
conduct. So it didn't say it would turn the immigration proceeding into a mini trial.
Well, facts, yeah, but
conviction.
It's...
Just that he, at that point, you said the government, modified categorical approach allows the government...
That is how the modified categorical approach arose. That's what it was.
Right.
It was the government being given the opportunity to amplify, to carry its burden, to amplify beyond the charging documents and the like. Now, the effect of Young is to say, well, the immigrant, who won't necessarily have access to as much as the government might be able to have access, mm-hmm. can come in with whatever the immigrant can cobble up to provide the facts. Right?
Well, I would dispute the last part of that phrase to prove the facts. The alien, in both situations, it's just a reverse image. Either the government or the alien, depending on the situation, has the burden to show what he was actually convicted
yes,
of.
Yes, but the modified categorical approach limits the government as to what it can put
and
in.
It would limit the alien similarly. As,
well,
yes, and
not
that
clear.
In certain circumstances, it might be said to treat the alien unfairly, but by the same token, when the government has the burden, there are going to be lots of cases where an alien really should be removed.
Yeah, but Moncrief makes it clear that those are different equities.
That's true. But I want to get back
because
to this.
Because it says, essentially, the government always has the backup of the exercise of its discretion not to grant. But what you're doing, what Young does, is knock out the immigrant flat out.
And
so the equities, as articulated by the Supreme Court, I mean, we debated it in Young, but now the Supreme Court pretty conclusively and more eloquently identifies the inequities and the problems for the immigration courts.
Right. Moncrief did not conclusively overrule Young, however.
I'm not suggesting that it did.
Yeah.
That's why I said, did it undermine Young?
I won't disagree with you that Young may require rethinking in light of Moncrief. I think it's way too early to say it's over. I don't think it did not overrule Young because it did not address the same issue. I think it's too early to even say it's undermined Young. I don't think this case is the case that you need to address whether Moncrief overruled Young, because in this case, the immigration judge went beyond what happened in Young or Moncrief, and he requested additional documents, and the alien said, I'm declining to provide those documents. So that in that case, the immigration judge said, you didn't meet your burden of production, which is part of the burden of proof. You know, in addition to the burden of persuasion, you didn't even meet the burden of production. So we're going to hold...
What was the sentence here? 24 days or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, that's correct.
So that's... Didn't it tell you that... joyriding? Not car theft?
Not necessarily.
Well,
it was his first
that's
offense.
That's pretty close, you know.
And...
Under federal law, for example, driving an automobile across state lines is a felony. So the state has this joyriding provision, and you know, 24 days. I used to think 3 days was a tough sentence when I was a municipal court judge, but 24 days, anyway, today that's nothing. Under the guidelines, it might have been 24 years. But anyway.
It was his first offense.
That's certainly an indication to me that that we're not dealing with moral turpitude, whatever that is.
Well, if it's a theft offense, it would be a moral, it would be a turpitudinous offense.
Turpitudinous, but now you're asking, immigration judge is asking this immigrant to go out and get over to the state court and get records and all that. It's not easy to do. Try to find out what traffic warrants you've got sitting there. Nobody knows.
But in this, the alien often is in as good a position of as the government to obtain.
Why?
Because he
Why?
Knows.
The government calls
he was
up
there,
and says,
he knows.
I'm the clerk of this court, and we need a little help. And I talk to the clerk of the state court. Will you help me? Oh, sure. So that's how you do it.
How many years previous was the conviction on the auto joyriding or theft?
What do you mean, how many years previously? I'm sorry.
How many years previous was that? Just roughly.
It was 2000 that he pled guilty.
So, I mean, the immigration judge kind of implied that it's real easy to get a plea transcript from a case that was 11 years old, where only 24 days had been given.
Well, the hearing was in 2005 is when he was requested to produce the documents. So it was 5 years old. But he never said, it's going to be too hard, I can't do it. He just said, I am not going to do it, because he chose to proceed under a different theory of the case.
Was there some record where he came in and says, I refused to do it?
The word refuse wasn't used, but we're not going to be producing it. We'll proceed on the record as it is. And he made this argument that under People v. West, there's nothing that the plea colloquy would have revealed. I would argue that it could reveal information about what offense he pled guilty to, if not the factual basis. For that reason, he failed to meet his burden of production, which is part of his burden of proof, and the immigration judge properly found that he had not established that he was not convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude.
What about the docket sheet? Was that in the record?
For the criminal proceeding, there was the electronic court printout of the proceedings. There was the plea form that he signed. That was in the record.
So what did that show?
That showed he pled guilty to a violation of, or was it guilty or nolo contendere to a violation of VC 10851, and then it said People v. West on it.
Yeah, that's where you can say, what I recall now is you say, I'm not going to plead guilty, but go to the facts, without admitting guilt, I'll take a nolo plea. So they don't go into the facts.
Yeah, and it may not be that the facts aren't really what we're looking for. What we're looking for is, what offense did he plead guilty to? When taking the plea, did the criminal court judge say, you've been charged with taking a vehicle with intent to permanently deprive the owner of possession? And if he pled nolo to that charge, that would be a theft offense. If the criminal court judge factored in.
Well, he just had him plead to the code section.
That's what the papers say, but we don't know what the judge said when taking the plea, and that's what we wanted to take a look at. It might not resolve the ambiguity, but it might. And the fact that the alien did not produce the document meant he did not meet his burden of production, and that was a reason for holding against him.
I don't know.
And then I'm out of time, so.
I'll try to find it for him.
The plea colloquy.
I don't think it's out there, but.
Yeah. If there are no further questions, I'm way out of time. So.
Thank you.
You know how many judicial officers the L.A. Superior Court has?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
Probably close to 1,000. Yeah.
Yeah. So finding, tracking down transcripts.
And they don't even have a system where their computers even talk to one another. You know?
So it's difficult. It is a project to track down these transcripts sometimes. And that's why when it's the alien's burden, it should be put on the alien, unless he establishes he can't do it, like he's in custody or something.
Well, who said he couldn't do it, the alien or his lawyer?
His lawyer said he wasn't going to do it. He did not say he could.
This guy over here?
No, it was a different.
No, he looks like he can do the impossible. Well, who was the lawyer?
It was Mr. Hiltz. I don't know if he's here today or not. Mr. Conner can state. But they chose to proceed on a different theory.
A lot of them go before the immigration judges with, the Justice Department allows immigrants before the immigration court to be represented by disbarred lawyers. You know that.
I know it happens, but we don't allow it.
We got another case.
Yeah. You're going to hear from me again if you want to
anyway,
continue the dialogue. So. Yeah. As Judge Fischer points out.
What?
Thank you.
Okay. All right. All right. Matter submitted.